All right, thanks everyone, you can be seated. So today we are here to have a hearing on Rule 1.15 of the Colorado Rules of Professional Conduct. And I'm going to turn this hearing over to Justice Marquez.
Thank you, Chief Justice. We're here to take public comment on proposed changes to Colorado Rule of Professional Conduct 1.15. We have six speakers scheduled to speak today. All of those speakers, with the exception of Mr. Settler, have been allotted 5 minutes, and Mr. Settler has asked for 10. So we're going to start with Marcy Glenn, the chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Marquez. Chief Justice Rice, members of the court, thank you. I'm happy to be here today. I feel as if today's subject matter is a little less charged than the last time we got together. I appear as the chair of the Court Standing Committee on the Rules of Professional Conduct, which has proposed extensive amendments to Rule 1.15 concerning client property, and of course this is the trust account rule. I want to speak very briefly, I don't think I'll use my 5 minutes by a wide margin, just about the process leading up to the proposed amendments. Some of that I explained in the cover letter that I sent to the court. But when I'm done, I'm going to turn the substantive comments over to Jamie Settler, who is Chief Deputy Regulation Counsel, so he knows. Jamie chaired the subcommittee that worked on these amendments with a lot of support from both members of our committee, our standing committee, and representatives from CULTAF. I believe that Jamie can confirm that they also reached out to get input from bankers who were not otherwise on the committee as they formulated their recommendations. The standing committee did not have the 1.15 on our to-do list. But in September of 2012, our friends at CULTAF approached us with the request that we consider recommending to the court a rule amendment that would implement in Colorado something that a number of other states have done, which is to require banks to offer comparable interest rates on CULTAF accounts to the rates and to the interest rates that they were providing on other investment accounts, interest bearing and other accounts. That led the standing committee to form a subcommittee, and in the course of doing that, we discussed the fact that Rule 1.15 could probably use a little more work, and so the scope of the subcommittee's work was expanded. Mr. Sutler chaired that subcommittee, as I said. It spent about a year working on these proposed amendments, including discussion at 3 standing committee meetings. Ultimately, in October of last year, the full standing committee majority of the members voted to recommend the changes. Because it is spring, I hope you will indulge me a gardening metaphor. Current Rule 1.15 is a bit of a thicket. If you all watching don't have to have trust accounts, but some of you may remember what it was like once upon a time if you went and if you practiced in private practice. It's a very important rule, but it's also a very confusingly written rule at this point. It looked a lot like an overgrown garden that originally had a nice design, but then had grown kind of willy-nilly with some plants overtaking others, some plants ending up not where they quite belonged. And when CULTAF came to us, we initially thought that we were going to just recommend possibly adding one new variety to the garden. But the more we looked at it, the more we decided that what 1.15 really needed was a hard pruning. And so that's what I consider what we had given you to be. There are some substantive changes that I tried to emphasize in the cover letter and that I expect Mr. Sutton may touch on. But for the most part, a lot of the changes are organizational, with an objective of making this a more user-friendly rule, eliminating obsolete provisions, achieving internal consistency, and all the kinds of things you try to do when you draft legislation or rules. Because it's such an important rule to so many lawyers, and so many of them get it wrong. And it's also a rule that we know that in many cases is being reviewed by non-lawyers, who are entrusted, hopefully with supervision, to implement its provisions. It's just really critical to have a workable rule. And so it's our hope that the court will go ahead and adopt the recommendations that we've made, and we appreciate the time that we know that we put into that process.
Are there any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And next we have James Sullivan, the Chief Deputy Regulation Counsel. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Marquez. And good afternoon, Chief Justice Rice and members of the court. It's been actually quite a pleasure, although a great deal of work, to chair this subcommittee and then bring these amendments to you. The subcommittee, as Marcy referred to, met a number of times. The committee itself met three times to discuss the changes we have proposed to you. The subcommittee, I think we probably met 15 to 20 times over the course of a year or so after November 2012. We have gone over this rule in minute details to try to make it the best rule possible. We looked at other rules from other jurisdictions, and they are on the board. I can tell you that there is no model rule. Although the ADA has a model rule that's about four paragraphs long, there is no model rule around the country. I think our rule, the one we proposed to you, is probably the best. I'm not going to spend a great deal of time going over the minute details of the changes we've made, but I am going to spend some time just discussing what's the rules concern, what they require lawyers to do. And I do want to make sure you understand that we teach this stuff at our trust account school. We teach it to some extent at our ethics school, and we also teach it at professionalism school for new admittees. So this is an area we are acutely aware of. We're acutely aware that some lawyers don't really understand it, because it's a very, it is a thicket. The old rule is much more thicketed. But I think we've made this rule less entwined. We've organized it into five sections, 115A, B, C, D, and E. Now, I'll discuss A, B, C, and D, but let me point out that the interest comparability rule, which brought this to the standing rule's attention back in 2012, is mainly in rule 115E. And Mark Hermannstadt of the COLTAB Board of Directors will discuss most of the comparability with you. But I do want to spend some time with you to talk about what the basic principles are. And those are the basic principles of Rule 115 and now 115A are that a lawyer shall segregate client funds from his own, her own funds. And then the lawyer is obligated to deliver funds to a client or another person when they're entitled to those funds. If there's a dispute about funds the lawyer holds in trust, the basic principle is you keep those funds in trust until the dispute is resolved. And that was in the old rule. It's in the new rule 115A. And then we've added a provision in 115A, which is subsection D, to make it clear that there are other rules that flow from 115A, there's B, C, D, and E. Now, the reason we are suggesting that the court number 115A, 115B, 115C, and D and E is because that's consistent with what the court did with Rule 116. And when we added the record retention rule, 116A, we separated by calling it 116A. So that's why we've done that numbering. We actually thought about that quite a bit. And because these things are important, and I don't think we should gloss over the numbering and make it accessible to lawyers. And that was one of our main goals. Let's make this rule more accessible. 115B is the rule that talks about what is required for a trust account, and what is also required for business accounts. Because lawyers are in private practice are required to have a trust account if they accept funds that belong to other people. That's in 115B. And also, lawyers in private practice are required to have a business account into which they deposit earned fees. That's in the old rule, continues on in the new rule. The trust account has to be in an approved institution. That's in 115B. The approved institution What that is, and what it has to be, is in 115E, the last rule. But approved institution is defined, and I'll go over that in just a second. An approved institution is approved by the Regulation Council, our office, and pursuant to an agreement that we will draft with the help of COLTAF, and also with the bank's help. And I don't think they're not expecting this. I think they are expecting it. They've all signed them in the past based upon the earlier rules. So. Now, a trust account has to be an interest-bearing and dividend-paying account. It has to be an insured account. Now, there are two provisions in the proposed rules that allow a client to agree with the lawyer this doesn't have to be an insured account. And it doesn't have to be an approved institution. And we consider that at quite some length. It should a client be able to agree with the lawyer that I don't want my money in an insured account, I want you to hold it somewhere else. And we decided that should be a client's option after informed consent. Then also we decided that a client could have the account in a non-interest or non-dividend paying account if the client chose to do so. That would be a client's choice. So that's an overview of the account requirements in 115B. 115C is a rule that is entitled use of trust accounts, and it includes very basic things such as a lawyer can't use an ATM card on a trust account, a lawyer can't make cash withdrawals from a trust account, only a lawyer admitted in Colorado can sign checks on a trust account, or someone supervised by a lawyer licensed in Colorado. They can sign trust. That's all the same. Nothing has changed in those substantive provisions, but we organize them differently. And then the rule requires that a lawyer reconcile his or her trust account on a quarterly basis. That's the same as it was before. So really none of these obligations on the lawyer have changed in the new proposed rule. Now, 115D is the required records rule. It's rather long, and it requires lots of records that a lawyer keep. It's actually rather easy to comply with. It's not that difficult. But just in general, a lawyer has to keep records that show the monies that came in, who they belonged to, the monies that went out, why they went out, what was the purpose of paying somebody. And the lawyer has to keep records of those transactions. We changed some of those requirements to become more modern because we don't get two canceled checks back anymore. And the old rule used to say you should get your canceled checks back from the bank. They're all kept electronically now. And the lawyer is required to have an electronic record or have access to it at his or her trust account. So that's in the required records rule also. Now, let me talk a little bit about 115E, which has a lot of new provisions in it, but I'm going to leave most of it to Mr. Hermanstadt for COLTAF. As I said, in order to have a COLTAF account or an approved trust account, an institution must agree with the Office of Attorney Regulation Council about what that institution will do. And that's nothing new. That's been done in the past. What's new are the interest comparability rules that occur in 115E7 and mainly 7 and 9. And but what banks do have to do is they have to agree to give us notice when a lawyer writes a bad check on their trust account, or the account goes below zero. It could be the same thing. Or some deposit hits the trust account that the lawyer should have been aware of, or maybe wasn't aware of, and it reduces the account below zero, or no, deposit withdrawal, sorry. So the banks have to give us notice of that situation, and it's a detailed notice they have to give us. Those details are in 115E. They were in the prior rule. There's really nothing new about that. We will be rewriting the agreement with the banks. We've anticipated that. We will be helping, hopefully, and well, I know Dana Poole at COLTAF and the rest of the COLTAF people will help us with writing that agreement. And I really don't anticipate any problems. This is really not new to the United States to have this interest comparability. Other states have been doing it for quite a while. The rule is very, 115E is very specific about the types of vehicles, I mean, the types of accounts a bank can offer for a COLTAF trust account. And they're detailed in the rule. And the nice thing about this interest comparability rule that I would just highlight is that banks have to go through a formula to figure out if they're offering comparable interest rates to other non-cold path type accounts, if they're offering them to cold path accounts. And if they don't want to go through that calculation, they simply default to what the cold path board of directors will set as an interest rate. And the cold path board will do that in consideration of non-factors. But it's a very simple thing for the banks to do. They either do it according to the formula in the rule 115E7, or they default to the default rate in 115E9. So it's rather easy, I think, for people to comply with. But it is daunting when you look at it. It really is. And we've faced this for a number of years since we've had Rule 115. We tried to make it as simple as possible, and I think we've done a really good job of getting it at a much more manageable, much more accessible rule for lawyers. And the main thing I do want to emphasize, it has come up before, is that it really doesn't change any obligation on lawyers. Their obligations are remaining the same. So with that, I thank you very much.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Silver. And next we will have Mark Hermanson, the cold path president. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Marcus. Chief Justice Rice.
You can actually raise that podium. There's an arrow button. There's actually a button, a toggle switch, just off the edge, just below the bottom.
Just below the lip of that, Mark.
There you go.
Okay. Yeah, there's a little switch.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you. It's easier for us to hear with microphone.
Okay.
Thank you.
There, is that better?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. My name is Mark Hermanstedt. I'm an attorney with Williams, Turner & Holmes in Grand Junction. I am currently the president of the board of directors of the Colorado Lawyer Trust Account Foundation, also known as COLCAF. I am here today to speak in favor and in support of the comparability provisions of the proposed Rule 115. As Mr. Settler just mentioned, those comparability provisions are contained in Section 115E at paragraphs C6 through C12. The purpose of these provisions is to require lawyers to hold their COLCAF accounts in financial institutions that pay the same interest rates or dividend rates on their COLCAF accounts as are paid under comparable non-COLCAF accounts. It's basically a principle of fundamental fairness. This rule mandates that banks that want to hold COLCAF accounts must pay the same interest rates on those accounts that they hold and that they pay for similar products for non-COLCAF accounts. This issue is very important to COLCAF. COLCAF was created by this court over 30 years ago to help fund the civil legal aid delivery system. I've been on COLCAF board since 2009. Comparability was being discussed before I came on the board. It's been a constant topic of discussion since I've been on the board. We've studied it, we've talked to experts on it, and have really come to favor the comparability principles. The COLCAF board is comprised of both lawyers and bankers. We have to have at least two bankers on the board. We currently have three bankers on the board, so they've been involved in the process also. The comparability provisions of the proposed rule have the full support, unanimous support of the COLCAF board. And we have a number of the COLCAF board members in the audience today and other interested people to support this proposal. COLCAF support has submitted a letter to the court dated May 14th that details the process that COLCAF has gone through in studying comparability and recommending the changes to Rule 115. It also discusses the positive effects of the comparability rule. Especially when interest rates start to rise again. Nobody's getting interest on any account, COLCAF or non-COLCAF nowadays, but when interest rates start rising is when it's going to become more important to us. I don't plan to repeat what's in that letter today. Basically, I'm here to answer questions. We also have two other COLCAF representatives listed as potential witnesses. Diane Poole, Executive Director, and Bobby Bianco, who's a member of the Board of Directors and the current Secretary of the Board. Both Ms. Poole and Mr. Bianco served on the subcommittee that created this proposed rule. They worked closely with national IOLTA representatives to look at other rules from other jurisdictions and to try to craft a rule that would fit for Colorado. They also worked closely with the Office of Regulation Counsel to make sure that the comparability provisions were appropriate for attorneys in Colorado. So with that, I'll end my prepared remarks. Any of the three of us are available to answer any questions the court may have on comparability.
Are there any questions from the court? Thank you very much, Mr. Nance. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And next we have William Bianco, poll tax secretary. Thank you.
Justice Marquez, Chief Justice Rice, members of the court. I don't have anything additional to add at this time unless the court has specific questions. I'm certainly prepared to talk about the need for a comparability rule, and Ms. Poole is here to talk about more of the details if the court does have questions. If not, we'd be happy to waive the rest of our time.
Could I ask a question?
Please.
Certainly.
After listening to this from afar, or maybe not so far, for a year or two, how long you've been going. One thing I've never been exactly sure about, maybe you could explain, is the mechanism by which we determine whether how a bank determines or how we determine what actually amounts to a comparable rate. And I don't mean real technical, but I just sort of mean who's the decision makers here.
That is an interesting question. I think that's going to be something we're going to have to deal with both in discussions with bankers as time goes on and also by relying upon our consultant who's helped us with crafting the rule and what should go into it, as well as ultimately helping us with determining a benchmark rate, determining when accounts are comparable and when they're not, and perhaps other technical aspects of it. Diana Poole can address this in more detail if you would like, but essentially that is a complicated question, and we are going to need some experts to help us determine when we've got an apple on an apple as opposed to an apple on an orange or whatever.
And do I understand it right that the division of authority sort of between the COLTAP board and regulation council is largely that you all will deal with the expertise and such and make these determinations, and Reg Council is kind of a functionary role there to maintain the list?
Precisely, Your Honor. We will do the work necessary to inform Regulation Council of which banks ought to be on the approved list, so that we're dealing with the banks and having our consultant involved when necessary to determine who really meets the requirements and who doesn't, and then turning that over to Regulation Council to publish to attorneys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bianco.
Thank you.
Diane Poole? Welcome, thank you.
Thank you, Justice Marquez, Chief Justice Rice, and members of the court. I, too, do not have any additional prepared remarks. Let me just elaborate a little bit on the question of how we go about determining what is comparable. Even right now, under the system we have, you know, we are in regular communication with the banks and encouraging them to give COLTAP accounts the best rate of interest that they will agree to. Frequently, it comes down to knowing what some of their tiered interest, well, when interest rates were at more normal levels, it came down to really knowing where their tiered interest rates were broken. So where, you know, if a certain sized account received a certain interest rate, as the COLTAP accounts got bigger, many community banks would agree to give us those higher interest rates on higher balance accounts. So in the process with comparability, one of the last COLTAP to do is, as right now we get a remittance from the bank that tells us what interest rate the bank is paying. They don't have to give us anything that, quote, justifies that rate. It can be whatever, as long as it's an interest-bearing account. In the comparability scheme, they would provide us with something which is really like a rate sheet, which surprisingly enough, because Coltab is a customer of the bank, sometimes when I even call for a rate sheet, they won't give it to me. I have to call a lawyer that holds their account at that bank to get a rate sheet. So sometimes it will just be a simple rate sheet that will list the products that they have. And so sometimes it's a relatively easy determination as to what will be comparable. Other times it is more of a negotiated thing with the bank. But one of the things our consultant said, because 33 jurisdictions already have this, 32 states and the District of Columbia, some of the difficulties that occurred early on just aren't as common. Most of the large banks that operate in multiple jurisdictions are doing this now in other jurisdictions. So they understand the process. In fact, there's a bank, one of the larger banks here that already thinks we're a comparability state. That is, it when it changes its rate, it asks, it sends me a little email that says, you know, do we need to sign a new agreement with you, which isn't the case right now because we just haven't negotiated rate with that bank. So I hope that kind of explains.
It does. Could I ask one other question? Sure. I mean, this just shows my lack of understanding, I guess, how the whole process works. But so are the decisions, do the decisions you make have anything to do with the risk of the products that this money is going to be invested in, or how you decide what is a comparable rate for other? I mean, I'm not sure how I'm asking this, but
I think I understand what you're asking. The rule itself defines the products that can be used for Coltab accounts, and it sets safety parameters. And some banks will have products that satisfy those; others won't. And if they don't, then the Coltab account will be in their ordinary business checking account.
Okay. So you have it's like bond ratings or something. You have some way of
right. There's I can give you the particular provision. Let me just get the number for you. Because the rule itself defines, it's in 6, 7, 8. It's in 8D, which is the cash management products that are considered appropriate for trust account money. And you'll see that they have very definite safety parameters that require the money to be collateralized, essentially. So Coltab won't be making that decision. That's in the rule. That we'll be only looking at products that would satisfy
the parameters. You can't be allowing investment in junk bonds to try to make more money or something.
No.
And Ms. Cole, how does this play out in the rural settings? If there are not major banks in a rural part of Colorado, how does this work? Are there exceptions for attorneys that are, my understanding, there used to be exceptions, exception and retained?
Yeah, the exception is retained. So if a lawyer practices in a community that does not have an approved bank, they're not required to leave their community to find an approved bank. And that's true in the current rule, and that exception continues in the proposed rule.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And last we have Frank Baumann for our Access to Justice Committee.
Justice Marquez, Chief Justice Rice, members of the court, I appreciate the opportunity to say a few words here today on behalf of the Colorado Access to Justice Commission, which I have the honor of chairing. As an aside, before I get to my formal comments, as a lawyer in private practice, I welcome Mr. Sutler and the other members of the committee's efforts to de-thicket the rules of professional conduct to make them more easy overall. But I speak today on behalf of comparability. The mission of the Access to Justice Commission, as this court is well aware, is to develop, coordinate, and implement policy initiatives to expand access to the civil legal system in the state of Colorado for people who are denied access. COLTAP and the funds that COLTAP provides are critical to that mission. In fact, they are vital. Prior to the downturn in the steep reduction in interest rates. COLTAF was the second most important source of funding for Colorado Legal Services, our statewide legal services provider, which also provides funds for pro bono programs and related programs across the state of Colorado. It was second only to the Legal Services Corporation in Washington, D.C. appropriation. That has changed as interest rates have fallen. But the purpose of comparability and the reason why the Access to Justice Commission supports comparability so strongly is that when interest rates go back to their normal range, comparability will accelerate and increase the amount of funds that are available for Colorado Legal Services and other access initiatives in Colorado. It will position, comparability will position COLTAB to benefit from by requiring lawyers to place their funds in institutions who pay a comparable rate, and we will maximize the revenues that we can move for also the legal services in the state of Colorado. As Ms. Poole noted, there are 32 states in the District of Columbia that have similar comparability provisions. Each of those states has had no problems to speak of in terms of access to accounts, difficulty for lawyers to comply with them, and I would anticipate none in the state of Colorado. Finally, I also wanted to talk to Justice Marquez's point about rural Colorado. The comparability provisions came before the Board of Governors of the Colorado Bar Association, and those issues were fully explored, and the Board of Governors unanimously agreed to support the comparability, and I believe has sent an updated letter to the court outlining that. So those issues were vetted, discussed, and to the satisfaction of the organized bar, at least, addressed. So in conclusion, the Access to Justice Commission strongly supports comparability and requests that this court take steps to approve it forthwith. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Are there any questions from the court?
Well, I have a question. So the proposal then, I should address Ms. Glenn, is to make this effective immediately,
yes,
if we adopt it?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and that concludes our list of speakers. I'll hand the baton back to the chief.
Okay, great. Well, thanks everybody for coming today. We find these hearings very helpful, and so we appreciate your time. We're in recess.
All right.